Hebron was a desert world. 4 centuries of terraforming had made the atmosphere breathable, and a few million acres of land arable. The creatures which had lived there before were small and tough, and infinitely wary, and so were the creatures imported from old Earth, including the humankind.
"Ah," gasped Saul the day they arrived in the sun-baked village of Dan, above the sun-baked kibbutz of Kfar Shalom. "What masochists we Jews are! 20,000 surveyed worlds fit our kind when the Hegira began, and those schmucks came here."
But it was not masochism which brought either the first colonists or Saul and his family. Hebron was mostly desert, but the fertile areas were almost frighteningly fertile. Sinai University was respected throughout the web, and its med center brought in wealthy patients and a healthy income for the cooperative. Hebron had a single Farcaster Terminex in New Jerusalem and allowed portals nowhere else. Belonging to neither the hegemony nor protectorate, Hebron taxed travelers heavily for Farcaster privilege and allowed no tourists outside New Jerusalem. For a Jew seeking privacy, it was perhaps the safest place in 300 worlds trod by man. The kibbutz was more a cooperative by tradition than in operation. The Weintraubs were welcomed to their home, a modest place, offering sun-dried adobe, curves instead of right angles, and bare wood floors, but also offering a view from the hill which showed an infinite expanse of desert beyond the orange and olive groves. The sun seemed to dry up everything, thought Saul, even worries and bad dreams. The light was a physical thing. In the evening their house glowed pink for an hour after the sun had set. Each morning Saul sat by his daughter's bed until she awoke. The first minutes of her confusion were always painful to him, but he made sure that he was the first thing Rachel saw each day. He held her while she asked her questions.
"Where are we, Daddy?"
"In a wonderful place, little one. I'll tell you all about it over breakfast."
"How did we get here?"
"By casting and flying and walking a bit," he would say. "It's not so far away, but far enough to make it an adventure."
"But my bed's here. My stuffed animals. Why don't I remember coming?"
And Saul would hold her gently by the shoulders and look into her brown eyes and say, "You had an accident, Rachel. Remember in The Homesick Toad, where Terence hits his head and forgets where he lives for a few days? It was sort of like that."
"Am I better?"
"Yes," Saul would say. "You're all better now." And the house would fill with the smell of breakfast, and they would go out to the terrace where Sarai waited. Rachel had more playmates than ever. The kibbutz cooperative had a school where she was always the welcome visitor, greeted anew each day. In the long afternoons, the children played in the orchards and explored along the cliffs. Avner, Robert, and Ephraim, the council elders, urged Saul to work on his book. Hebron prided itself on the number of scholars, artists, musicians, philosophers, writers, and composers it sheltered as citizens and long-term residents. The house, they pointed out, was a gift of the state. Saul's pension, though small by web standards, was more than adequate for their modest needs in Kfar Shalom. To Saul's surprise, however, he found that he enjoyed physical labor. Whether working in the orchards or clearing stones in the unclaimed fields, or repairing a wall above the city, Saul found that his mind and spirit were freer than they had been in many years. He discovered that he could wrestle with Kierkegaard while he waited for mortar to dry, and find new insights in Kant and Van Dur while carefully checking the apples for worms. At the age of 73 standard, Saul earned his first calluses. In the evenings, he would play with Rachel and then take a walk in the foothills with Sarai as Judy or one of the other neighbor girls watched their sleeping child. One weekend, they went away to New Jerusalem, just Saul and Sarai.
The first time they had been alone together for that long, since Rachel returned to live with them 17 standard years before. But everything was not idyllic. Too frequent were the nights when Saul awoke alone and walked barefoot down the hall to see Saray watching over Rachel in her sleep. And often, at the end of a long day, bathing Rachel in the old ceramic tub or tucking her in as the walls glowed pinkly, the child would say,
"I like it here, Daddy, but can we go home tomorrow?"
And Saul would nod. And after the goodnight story and the lullaby and the goodnight kiss, sure that she was asleep, he would begin to tiptoe out of the room only to hear the muffled, "Later, alligator," from the blanketed form on the bed, to which he had to reply, "While, crocodile." And lying in bed himself, next to the softly breathing and possibly sleeping length of the woman he loved, Saul would watch the strips of pale light from one or both of Hebron's small moons move across the rough walls, and he would talk to God. Saul had been talking to God for some months before he realized what he was doing. The idea amused him. The dialogues were in no way prayers, but took the form of angry monologues, which, just short of the point where they became diatribes, became vigorous arguments with himself. Only not just with himself. Saul realized one day that the topics of the heated debates were so profound, the stakes to be settled so serious, the ground covered so broad, that the only person he could possibly be berating for such shortcomings was God himself. Since the concept of a personal God, lying awake at night, worrying about human beings, intervening in the lives of individuals, always had been totally absurd to Saul, the thought of such dialogues made him doubt his sanity. But the dialogues continued. Saul wanted to know how any ethical system, much less a religion so indomitable that it had survived every evil mankind could throw at it, could flow from a command from God for a man to slaughter his son. It did not matter to Saul that the command had been rescinded at the last moment. It did not matter that the command was a test of obedience. In fact, the idea that it was the obedience of Abraham which allowed him to become the father of all the tribes of Israel was precisely what drove Saul into fits of fury. After 55 years of dedicating his life and work to the story of ethical systems, Saul Weintraub had come to a single, unshakable conclusion. Any allegiance to a deity or concept or universal principle which put obedience above decent behavior toward an innocent human being was evil. "So define innocent," came the vaguely amused, faintly querulous voice which Saul associated with these arguments. "A child is innocent," thought Saul. "Isaac was. Rachel is." "Innocent by the mere fact of being a child?" "Yes. And there is no situation where the blood of the innocent must be shed for a greater cause." "No," thought Saul, "none." "But the innocent are not restricted to children, I presume." Saul hesitated, sensing a trap, trying to see where his subconscious interlocutor was heading. He could not. "No," he thought, "the innocent include others as well as children. Such as Rachel, at age 24. The innocent should not be sacrificed at any age." "That's right." "Perhaps this is part of the lesson which Abraham needed to learn before he could be father to the blessed of the nations of the earth." "What lesson?" thought Saul. "What lesson?" But the voice in his mind had faded, and now there were only the sounds of nightbirds outside and the soft breathing of his wife beside him. Rachel could still read at age 5. Saul had trouble remembering when she had learned to read. It seemed she always had been able to. 4 standard, said Saray. "It was early summer, 3 months after her birthday. We were picnicking in the field above the college. Rachel was looking at her Winnie the Pooh book, and suddenly she said, 'I hear a voice in my head.' Saul remembered then. He also remembered the joy he and Sarai had felt at the rapid acquisition of new skills Rachel had shown at that age. He remembered because now they were confronted with the reverse of that process.
"Dad," said Rachel, from where she lay on the floor of his study, carefully coloring, "how long has it been since Mom's birthday?"
"It was on Monday," said Saul, preoccupied with something he was reading. Sarai's birthday had not yet come, but Rachel remembered it.
"I know, but how long has it been since then?"
"Today is Thursday," said Saul. He was reading a long Talmudic treatise on obedience.
"I know, but how many days?"
Saul put down the hard copy.
"Can you name the days of the week?"
Barnard's world had used the old calendar.
"Sure," said Rachel. "Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday." "You said Saturday already."
"Yeah, but how many days ago?"
"Can you count from Monday to Thursday?"
Rachel frowned, moved her lips. She tried again, counting on her fingers this time.
4 days.
"Good," said Saul. "Can you tell me what 10 minus 4 is, kiddo?"
"What does minus mean?"
Saul forced himself to look at his papers again.
"Nothing," he said. "Something you'll learn at school." "When we go home tomorrow?"
"Yes." One morning when Rachel went off with Judy to play with the other children, she was too young to attend school any longer, Sarai said,
"Saul, we have to take her to Hyperion."
Saul stared at her.
"What?"
"You heard me. We can't wait until she is too young to walk, to talk. Also, we're not getting any younger." Sarai barked a mirthless laugh.
"That sounds strange, doesn't it? But we're not. The Poulsen treatments will be wearing off in a year or two."
"Sarai, did you forget? The doctors all say that Rachel could not survive cryogenic fugue. No one experiences FTL travel without fugue state. The Hawking effect can drive one mad, or worse."
"It doesn't matter," said Sarai. "Rachel has to return to Hyperion."
"What on earth are you talking about?" said Saul, angered. Sarai gripped his hand. "Do you think you're the only one who has had the dream?"
"Dream?" managed Saul.
She sighed and sat at the white kitchen table. Morning light struck the plants on the sill like a yellow spotlight.
"The dark place," she said. "The red lights above. The voice telling us to go to Hyperion, to make an offering."
Saul licked his lips, but there was no moisture there. His heart pounded.
Whose name is called?"
Sarai looked at him strangely.
"Both of our names. If you weren't there, in the dream with me, I could never have borne it all these years."
Saul collapsed into his chair. He looked down at the strange hand and forearm lying on the table. The knuckles of the hand were beginning to enlarge with arthritis. The forearm was heavily veined, marked with liver spots. It was his hand, of course. He heard himself say,
"You never mentioned it. Never said a word."
This time, Sarai's laugh was without bitterness.
"As if I had to. All those times, both of us coming awake in the dark, and you covered with sweat. I knew from the first time that it was not merely a dream. We have to go, Father. Go to Hyperion."
Saul moved the hand. It still did not feel a part of him.
"Why, for God's sake? Why, Sarai? We can't offer Rachel?"
"Of course not, Father."
"Haven't you thought about this? We have to go to Hyperion, to wherever the dream tells us to go, and offer ourselves instead."
"Offer ourselves?" repeated Saul. He wondered if he was having a heart attack. His chest ached so terribly that he could not take in a breath. He sat for a full minute in silence, convinced that if he attempted to utter a word, only a sob would escape. After another minute, he said,
"How long have you thought about this, Mother?"
Do you mean known what we must do? A year. A little more. Just after her 5th birthday.
A year?
Why haven't you said something?
I was waiting for you. To realize. To know.
Saul shook his head. The room seemed far away and slightly tilted.
No, I mean, it doesn't seem... I have to think, Mother.
Saul watched as the strange hand patted Saray's familiar hand. She nodded.
Saul spent 3 days and nights in the arid mountains, eating only the thick-crusted bread he had brought and drinking from his condenser therm. 10,000 times in the past 20 years he had wished that he could take Rachel's illness, that if anyone had to suffer it should be the father, not the child. Any parent would feel that way, did feel that way, every time his child lay injured or racked with fever. Surely it could not be that simple. In the heat of the 3rd afternoon, as he lay half-dozing in the shade of a thin tablet of rock, Saul learned that it was not that simple.
Can that be Abraham's answer to God? That he would be the offering, not Isaac?
It could have been Abraham's. It cannot be yours.
Why?
As if in answer, Saul had the fever vision of naked adults filing toward the ovens past armed men, mothers hiding their children under piles of coats. He saw men and women with flesh hanging in burned strips, carrying the dazed children from the ashes of what once had been a city. Saul knew that these images were no dreams, were the very stuff of the 1st and 2nd Holocausts, and, in his understanding, knew before the voice spoke in his mind what the answer was, what it must be. The parents have offered themselves. That sacrifice already has been accepted. We are beyond that.
Then what? What?
Silence answered him. Saul stood in the full glare of the sun. Almost fell. A blackbird wheeled overhead, or in his vision. Saul shook his fist at the gunmetal sky.
You use Nazis as your instruments. Madmen, monsters. You're a goddamn monster yourself. No.
The earth tilted and Saul fell on his side against sharp rocks. He thought that it was not unlike leaning against a rough wall. A rock the size of his fist burned his cheek.
The correct answer for Abraham was obedience, thought Saul. Ethically, Abraham was a child himself. All men were at that time. The correct answer for Abraham's children was to become adults and to offer themselves instead. What is the correct answer for us?
There was no answer. The ground and sky quit spinning. After a while, Saul rose shakily, rubbed the blood and grit from his cheek, and walked down to the town in the valley below.
No, Saul told Saray, we will not go to Hyperion. It is not the correct solution. You would have us do nothing, then?
Saray's lips were white with answer, but her voice was firmly in control.
No, I would have us not do the wrong thing.
Saray expelled her breath in a hiss. She waved toward the window where the 4-year-old was visible playing with her toy horses in the backyard.
Do you think she has time for us to do the wrong thing, or anything, indefinitely?
Sit down, Mother. Saray remained standing. There was the faintest sprinkling of spilled sugar on the front of her tan cotton dress. Saul remembered the young woman rising nude from the phosphorescent wake of the Motul Isle on Maui Covenant.
We have to do something, she said.
We've seen over 100 medical and scientific experts. She's been tested, prodded, probed, and tortured by 24 research centers. I've been to the Shrike Church on every world in this web. They won't see me. Melio and the other Hyperion experts at Rikes say that the Shrike cult has nothing like the Merlin sickness in their doctrine, and the indigenes on Hyperion have no legends of the malady or clues to its cure. Research during the 3 years the team was on Hyperion showed nothing. Now research there is illegal. Access to the time tombs is granted only to the so-called pilgrims. Even getting a travel visa to Hyperion is becoming almost impossible. And if we take Rachel, the trip may kill her. Saul paused for breath, touched Saray's arm again. I'm sorry to repeat all this, Mother, but we have done something. Not enough, said Saray. What if we go as pilgrims? Saul folded his arms in frustration. The Church of the Shrike chooses its sacrificial victims from thousands of volunteers. The web is full of stupid, depressed people. Few of these return.
Doesn't that prove something? Saray whispered quickly, urgently. Somebody or something is preying on these people.
Bandits, said Saul. Saray shook her head.
The Golem.
You mean the Shrike?
It's the Golem, insisted Saray, the same one we see in the dream.
Saul was uneasy. I don't see a Golem in the dream. What Golem?
The red eyes that watch, said Saray. It's the same Golem that Rachel heard that night in the Sphinx.
How do you know that she heard anything?
It's in the dream, said Saray, before we enter the place where the Golem waits.
We haven't dreamed the same dream, said Saul. Mother, why haven't you told me this before?
I thought I was going mad, whispered Saray.
Saul thought of his secret conversations with God and put his arm around his wife.
Oh, Saul, she whispered against him. It hurts so much to watch, and it's so lonely here.
Saul held her. They had tried to go home. Home would always be Barnard's world, half a dozen times to visit family and friends. But each time the visits were ruined by an invasion of newsteeps and tourists. It was no one's fault. News traveled almost instantaneously through the mega-datasphere of 160 web-worlds. To scratch the curiosity itch, one had only to pass a universal card across a Terminex disky and step through a Farcaster. They had tried arriving unannounced and traveling incognito, but they were not spies, and the efforts were pitiful. Within 24 standard hours of their re-entry to the web, they were besieged. Research institutes and large med centers easily provided the security screen for such a visit, but friends and family suffered. Rachel was news.
Perhaps we could invite Tetha and Richard again, began Saray.
I have a better idea, said Saul. Go yourself, Mother. You want to see your sister, but you also want to see, hear, and smell home. Watch a sunset where there are no iguanas. Walk in the fields. Go.
Go? Just me?
I couldn't be away from Rachel. Nonsense, said Saul. Twice in 20 years, almost 40, if we count the good days before. Anyway, twice in 20 years doesn't constitute child neglect. It's a wonder that this family can stand one another. We've been cooped up together so long. Saray looked at the tabletop, lost in thought.
But wouldn't the news people find me?
I bet not, said Saul. It's Rachel they seem to key on. If they do hound you, come home. But I bet you can have a week visiting everyone at home before the teeps catch on.
A week, gasped Saray.
I couldn't. Of course you can. In fact, you must. It will give me a few days to spend more time with Rachel. And then when you come back, refreshed, I'll spend some days selfishly working on the book.
The Kierkegaard one?
No. Something I've been playing with called The Abraham Problem.
Clumsy title, said Saray.
It's a clumsy problem, said Saul. Now go, get packed. We'll fly you to New Jerusalem tomorrow so you can cast out before the Sabbath begins.
I'll think about it, she said, sounding unconvinced.
You'll pack, said Saul, hugging her again. When the hug was completed, he had turned her away from the window so that she faced the hallway and the bedroom door. Go! When you return from home, I'll have thought of something we can do.
Saray paused. Do you promise?
Saul looked at her.
I promise. I will. Before time destroys everything. I swear, as Rachel's father, that I'll find a way.
Saray nodded, more relaxed than he had seen her in months.
I'll go pack, she said.
When he and the child returned from New Jerusalem the next day, Saul went out to water the meager lawn while Rachel played quietly inside. When he came in, the pink glow of sunset infusing the walls with a sense of sea warmth and quiet, Rachel was not in her bedroom or the other usual places.
Rachel?
When there was no answer, he checked the backyard again, the empty street.
Rachel!
Saul ran in to call the neighbors, but suddenly there was the slightest of sounds from the deep closet Saray used for storage. Saul quietly opened the screen panel. Rachel sat beneath the hanging clothes, Saray's antique pine box open between her legs. The floor was littered with photos and hollow chips of Rachel as a high school student, Rachel on the day she set off for college, Rachel standing in front of a carved mountainside on Hyperion. Rachel's research comm log lay whispering on the four-year-old Rachel's lap. Saul's heart seized at the familiar sound of the confident young woman's voice.
Daddy, said the child on the floor, her own voice a tiny, frightened echo of the voice on the comm log. You never told me that I had a sister.
You don't, little one.
Rachel frowned. Is this Mommy, when she was not so big? Uh-uh, can't be. Her name's Rachel, too, she says. How can...
It's all right, he said. I'll explain. Saul realized that the phone was ringing in the living room. Had been ringing. Just a moment, sweetie. I'll be right back. The hollow that formed above the pit was of a man Saul had never seen before. Saul did not activate his own imager, eager to get rid of the caller.
Yes,
he said abruptly. M. Weintraub? M. Weintraub, who used to live on Barnard's World, currently in the village of Dan on Hebron? Saul started to disconnect and then paused. Their access code was unfiled. Occasionally a salesperson called from New Jerusalem, but off-world calls were rare. And Saul suddenly realized, his stomach feeling a stab of cold, it was past sundown on the Sabbath. Only emergency hollow calls were allowed.
Yes, said Saul.
M. Weintraub, said the man, staring blindly past Saul. There's been a terrible accident. When Rachel awoke, her father was sitting by the side of her bed. He looked tired. His eyes were red and his cheeks were gray with stubble above the line of his beard.
Good morning, Daddy.
Good morning, sweetheart. Rachel looked around and blinked. Some of her dolls and toys and things were there, but the room was not hers. The light was different. The air felt different. Her daddy looked different.
Where are we, Daddy?
We've gone on a trip, little one.
Where to?
It doesn't matter right now. Hop out, sweetie. Your bath is ready, and then we have to get dressed. A dark dress she had never seen before lay at the base of her bed. Rachel looked at the dress, and then back at her father.
Daddy, what's the matter? Where's Mommy?
Saul rubbed his cheek. It was the third morning since the accident. It was the day of the funeral. He had told her each of the preceding days, because he could not imagine lying to her then. It seemed the ultimate betrayal of both Saray and Rachel. But he did not think he could do it again. There's been an accident, Rachel, he said, his voice a pained rasp. Mommy died. We're going to go say goodbye to her today. Saul paused. He knew by now that it would take a minute for the fact of her mother's death to become real for Rachel. On the first day, he had not known if a 4-year-old could truly comprehend the concept of death. He knew now that Rachel could. Later, as he held the sobbing child, Saul tried to understand the accident he had described so briefly to her. EMVs were by far the safest form of personal transportation mankind had ever designed. Their lifters could fail, but, even so, the residual charge in the EM generators would allow the air car to descend safely from any altitude. The basic, fail-safe design of an EMV's collision avoidance equipment had not changed in centuries. But everything failed. In this case, it was a joyriding teenage couple in a stolen EMV outside the traffic lanes, accelerating to Mach 1.5, with all lights and transponders off to avoid detection, who defied all odds by colliding with Aunt Tether's ancient Vicon as it descended toward the Bassard City Opera House landing apron. Besides Tether and Saray and the teenagers, three others died in the crash as pieces of falling vehicles cartwheeled into the crowded atrium of the Opera House itself. Saray. "Will we ever see Mommy again?" Rachel asked between sobs. She had asked this each time. "I don't know, sweetheart," responded Saul truthfully. The funeral was at the family cemetery in Cates County on Barnard's World. The press did not invade the graveyard itself, but Teeps hovered beyond the trees and pressed against the black iron gate like an angry storm tide. Richard wanted Saul and Rachel to stay a few days, but Saul knew what pain would be inflicted on the quiet farmer if the press continued their assault. Instead, he hugged Richard, spoke briefly to the clamoring reporters beyond the fence, and fled to Hebron with a stunned and silent Rachel in tow. Newsteeps followed to New Jerusalem and then attempted to follow to Dan, but military police overrode their chartered EMVs, threw a dozen in jail as an example, and revoked the Farcaster visas of the rest. In the evening, Saul walked the ridgelines above the village while Judy watched his sleeping child. He found that his dialogue with God was audible now, and he resisted the urge to shake his fist at the sky, to shout obscenities, to throw stones. Instead, he asked questions, always ending with, "Why?" There was no answer. Hebron's sun set behind distant ridges, and the rocks glowed as they gave up their heat. Saul sat on a boulder and rubbed his temples with his palms. Saray. They had lived a full life, even with the tragedy of Rachel's illness hanging over them. It was too ironic that in Saray's first hour of relaxation with her sister, Saul moaned aloud. The trap, of course, had been in their total absorption with Rachel's illness. Neither had been able to face the future beyond Rachel's death, disappearance. The world had hinged upon each day their child lived, and no thought had been given to the chance of accident, the perverse anti-logic of a sharp-edged universe. Saul was sure that Saray had considered suicide just as he had, but neither of them could ever have abandoned the other. Or Rachel. He had never considered the possibility of being alone with Rachel when... Saray. At that moment, Saul realized that the often angry dialogue which his people had been having with God for so many millennia had not ended with the death of old Earth, nor with the new diaspora, but continued still. He and Rachel and Saray had been part of it, were part of it now. He let the pain come. It filled him with the sharp-edged agony of resolve. Saul stood on the ridgeline and wept as darkness fell. In the morning, he was next to Rachel's bed when sunlight filled the room.
Good morning, Daddy.
Good morning, sweetheart.
Where are we, Daddy?
We've gone on a trip. It's a pretty place.
Where's Mommy?
She's with Aunt Tether today.
Will we see her tomorrow?
Yes, said Saul. Now let's get you dressed and I'll make breakfast. Saul began to petition the Church of the Shrike when Rachel turned 3. Travel to Hyperion was severely limited, and access to the time tombs had become all but impossible. Only the occasional Shrike pilgrimage sent people to that region. Rachel was sad that she had to be away from her mother on her birthday, but the visit of several children from the kibbutz distracted her a bit. Her big present was an illustrated book of fairy tales, which Sarai had picked out in New Jerusalem months before. Saul read some of the stories to Rachel before bedtime. It had been 7 months since she could read any of the words herself. But she loved the stories, especially Sleeping Beauty, and made her father read it to her twice.
"I'm going to show Mommy it when we get home," she said through a yawn as Saul turned out the overhead light.
"Good night, kiddo," he said softly, pausing at the door.
"Hey, Daddy."
"Yes?"
"Later, alligator."
"While, crocodile." Rachel giggled into her pillow. It was, Saul thought during the final 2 years, not so much different from watching a loved one falling into old age. Only worse. 1,000 times worse. Rachel's permanent teeth had fallen out over intervals between her 8th and 2nd birthdays. Baby teeth replaced them, but by her 18th month, half of these had receded into her jaw. Rachel's hair, always her one vanity, grew shorter and thinner. Her face lost its familiar structure as baby fat obscured the cheekbones and firm chin. Her coordination failed by degrees, noticeable at first in a sudden clumsiness as she handled a fork or pencil. On the day she could no longer walk, Saul put her down in her crib early and then went into a study to get thoroughly and quietly drunk. Language was the hardest for him. Her vocabulary loss was like the burning of a bridge between them, the severing of a final line of hope. It was some time after her 2nd birthday receded that Saul tucked her in and, pausing in the doorway, said, "Later, alligator."
"Huh?"
"See you later, alligator." Rachel giggled. "You say, 'in a while, crocodile,'" said Saul. He told her what an alligator and crocodile were.
"In a while, alligator," giggled Rachel. In the morning, she had forgotten.
Saul took Rachel with him as he traveled the web, no longer caring about the newsteeps, petitioning the Shrike Church for pilgrimage rights, lobbying the Senate for a visa and access to forbidden areas on Hyperion, and visiting any research institute or clinic which might offer a cure. Months were lost while more medics admitted failure. When he fled back to Hebron, Rachel was 15 standard months old. In the ancient units used on Hebron, she weighed 25 pounds and measured 30 inches tall. She could no longer dress herself. Her vocabulary consisted of 25 words, of which her favorites were Mommy and Daddy. Saul loved carrying his daughter. There were times when the curve of her head against his cheek, her warmth against his chest, the smell of her skin, all worked to allow him to forget the fierce injustice of it all. At those times, Saul would have been temporarily at peace with the universe if only Sarai had been there. As it was, there were temporary ceasefires in his angry dialogue with a god in whom he did not believe.
What possible reason can there be for this?
What reason has been visible for all of the forms of pain suffered by humankind? Precisely, thought Saul, wondering if he had just won a point for the first time. He doubted it. The fact of a thing not being visible does not mean it does not exist. That's clumsy. It shouldn't take three negatives to make a statement, especially to state something as non-profound as that.
Precisely, Saul. You're beginning to get the drift of all this.
What?
There was no answer to his thoughts. Saul lay in his house and listened to the desert wind blow.
Rachel's last word was Mama, uttered when she was just over 5 months old. She awoke in her crib and did not, could not, ask where she was. Her world was one of mealtimes, naps, and toys. Sometimes when she cried, Saul wondered if she was crying for her mother. Saul shopped in the small stores in Dan, taking the infant with him as he selected diapers, nursing packs, and the occasional new toy. The week before Saul left for Tau Ceti Center, Ephraim and the two other elders came to talk. It was evening, and the fading light glowed on Ephraim's bald scalp.
Saul, we're worried about you. The next few weeks will be hard. The women want to help. We want to help.
Saul laid his hand on the older man's forearm.
It's appreciated, Ephraim. Everything the last few years is appreciated. This is our home now, too. Saray would have wanted me to say thank you. But we're leaving on Sunday. Rachel is going to get better.
The three men on the long bench looked at one another. Avner said,
They've found a cure?
No, said Saul. But I've found a reason to hope.
Hope is good, Robert said in cautious tones. Saul grinned, his teeth white against the gray of his beard.
It had better be, he said. Sometimes it is all we're given.
The studio holo camera zoomed in for a close-up of Rachel as the infant sat cradled in Saul's arm on the set of Common Talk.
So you're saying, said Devin Whiteshire, the show's host and third best-known face in the web datasphere, that the Shrike Church's refusal to allow you to return to the Time Tombs and the hegemony's tardiness in processing a visa, these things will doom your child to this extinction?
Precisely, said Saul. The voyage to Hyperion cannot be made in under 6 weeks. Rachel is now 12 weeks old. Any further delay by either the Shrike Church or the web bureaucracy will kill this child.
The studio audience stirred. Devin Whiteshire turned toward the nearest imaging remote. His craggy, friendly visage filled the monitor frame.
This man doesn't know if he can save his child, said Whiteshire, his voice powerful with subtle feeling. But all he asks is a chance. Do you think he and the baby deserve one? If so, access your planetary representatives and your nearest Church of the Shrike Temple. The number of your nearest temple should be appearing now.
He turned back to Saul. We wish you luck, M. Weintraub. And, Whiteshire's large hand touched Rachel's cheek, we wish you Godspeed, our young friend. The monitor image held on Rachel until it faded to black.
The Hawking effect caused nausea, vertigo, headache, and hallucinations. The first leg of the voyage was the 10-day transit to Parvati on the hegemony torch ship HS Intrepid. Saul held Rachel and endured. They were the only people fully conscious aboard the warship. At first, Rachel cried, but after some hours she lay quietly in Saul's arms and stared up at him with large dark eyes. Saul remembered the day she was born. The medics had taken the infant from atop Saray's warm stomach and handed her to Saul. Rachel's dark hair was not much shorter then, her gaze no less profound. Eventually they slept from sheer exhaustion. Saul dreamed that he was wandering through a structure with columns the size of redwood trees and a ceiling lost to sight far above him. Red light bathed cool emptiness. Saul was surprised to find that he still carried Rachel in his arms.
Rachel, as a child, had never been in his dream before. The infant looked up at him, and Saul felt the contact of her consciousness as surely as if she had spoken aloud. Suddenly, a different voice, immense and cold, echoed through the void.
"Saul, take your daughter, your only daughter Rachel, whom you love, and go to the world called Hyperion, and offer her there as a burnt offering at one of the places of which I shall tell you."
Saul hesitated and looked back to Rachel. The baby's eyes were deep and luminous as she looked up at her father. Saul felt the unspoken yes. Holding her tightly, he stepped forward into the darkness and raised his voice against the silence.
"Listen. There will be no more offerings, neither child nor parent. There will be no more sacrifices for anyone other than our fellow human. The time of obedience and atonement is past."
Saul listened. He could feel the pounding of his heart and Rachel's warmth against his arm. From somewhere high above, there came the cold sound of wind through unseen fissures. Saul cupped his hand to his mouth and shouted,
"That's all! Now either leave us alone, or join us as a father, rather than a receiver of sacrifices. You have the choice of Abraham."
Rachel stirred in his arms as a rumble grew out of the stone floor. Columns vibrated. The red gloom deepened, and then winked out, leaving only darkness. From far away there came the boom of huge footsteps. Saul hugged Rachel to him as a violent wind roared past. There was a glimmer of light as both he and Rachel awoke on the HS Intrepid, outward bound for Parvati, to transfer to the tree ship Yggdrasil for the planet Hyperion. Saul smiled at his 7-week-old daughter. She smiled back. It was her last, or her first, smile.
The main cabin of the wind wagon was silent when the old scholar finished his story. Saul cleared his throat and took a drink of water from a crystal goblet. Rachel slept on in the makeshift cradle of the open drawer. The wind wagon rocked gently on its way, the rumble of the great wheel and the hum of the main gyroscope a lulling background noise.
"My God,"
Braun Lamia said softly. She started to speak again and then merely shook her head. Martin Silenus closed his eyes and said,
"Considering that all hatred driven hence, the soul recovers radical innocence and learns at last that it is self-delighting, self-appeasing, self-affrighting, and that its own sweet will is heaven's will. She can, though every face will scowl and every windy quarter howl or every bellows burst, be happy still."
Saul Weintraub asked,
"William Butler Yeats?"
Silenus nodded.
"A prayer for my daughter.
I think I'm going up on deck for a breath of air before turning in,"
said the consul.
"Would anyone care to join me?"
Everyone did. The breeze of their passage was refreshing as the group stood on the quarter-deck and watched the darkened sea of grass rumble by. The sky was a great, star-splashed bowl above them, scarred by meteor trails. The sails and rigging creaked with a sound as old as human travel.
"I think we should post guards tonight,"
said Colonel Cassad.
"One person on watch while the others sleep. 2-hour intervals."
"I agree. I'll take the first watch."
"In the morning,"
began Cassad. "Look!" cried Father Hoyt. They followed his pointing arm. Between the blaze of constellations, colored fireballs flared. Green, violet, orange, green again, illuminating the great plain of grass around them like flashes of heat lightning. The stars and meteor trails paled to insignificance beside the sudden display. Explosions? Ventured the priest.
Space battle,
said Kassad.
Cislunar, fusion weapons.
He went below quickly.
The tree,
said Hetmastin, pointing to a speck of light which moved among the explosions like an ember floating through a fireworks display. Kassad returned with his powered binoculars and handed them around.
Ousters? Is it the invasion?
Ousters, almost certainly. But almost as certainly, just a scouting raid. See the clusters? Those are hegemony missiles being exploded by the ouster ram scout's countermeasures.
The binoculars came to the console. The flashes were quite clear now, an expanding cumulus of flame. He could see the speck and long blue tail of at least two scout ships fleeing from the hegemony pursuers.
I don't think,
began Kassad, and then stopped as the ship and sails and sea of grass glowed bright orange in reflected glare.
Dear Christ, whispered Father Hoyt. They've hit the tree ship.
The consul swept the glasses left. The growing nimbus of flames could be seen with the naked eye. But in the binoculars, the kilometer-long trunk and branch array of the Yggdrasil was visible for an instant as it burned and flared, long tendrils of flame arcing away into space as the containment fields failed and the oxygen burned. The orange cloud pulsed, faded, and fell back on itself as the trunk became visible for a final second, even as it glowed and broke up, like the last long ember in a dying fire. Nothing could have survived. The tree ship Yggdrasil, with its crew and complement of clones and semi-sentient Urg drivers, was dead. The consul turned toward Hetmastin and belatedly held out the binoculars.
I'm so sorry.
The tall Templar did not take the glasses. Slowly he lowered his gaze from the skies, pulled forward his cowl, and went below without a word. The death of the tree ship was the final explosion. When 10 minutes had passed and no more flares had disturbed the night, Braun Lamia spoke.
Do you think they got them?
The ousters?
Said Kassad.
Probably not. The scout ships are built for speed and defense. They're light minutes away by now.
Did they go after the tree ship on purpose?
Asked Silenus. The poet sounded very sober.
I think not. Merely a target of opportunity.
Target of opportunity,
echoed Saul Weintraub. The scholar shook his head.
I'm going to get a few hours' sleep before sunrise.
One by one the others went below. When only Kassad and the consul were left on deck, the consul said,
Where should I stand watch?
Make a circuit. From the main corridor at the base of the ladder, you can see all of the stateroom doors and the entrance to the mess and galley. Come above and check the gangway and decks. Keep the lanterns lit. Do you have a weapon?
The consul shook his head. Kassad handed over his death wand.
It's on tight beam, about half a meter at 10 meters range. Don't use it unless you're sure that there's an intruder. The rough plate that slides forward is the safety. It's on.
The consul nodded, making sure that his finger stayed away from the firing stud.
I'll relieve you in 2 hours,
said Kassad. He checked his comm log.
It'll be sunrise before my watch is over.
Kassad looked at the sky as if expecting the Yggdrasil to reappear and continue its firefly path across the sky. Only the stars glowed back. On the northeastern horizon, a moving mass of black promised a storm. Kassad shook his head.
A waste,
he said, and went below. The consul stood there a while and listened to the wind in the canvas, the creak of rigging, and the rumble of the wheel. After a while, he went to the railing and stared at darkness while he thought.